after Beethoven? Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach's Sarabande from the G major French suite, played by Mitsuko Uchida as an encore. And members of the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra applauding her. Strings tapping their bows, applause from the woodwind and the timpani at the back. I asked Uchida why we'd had to wait so long for her to return for proms, and she simply shrugged her shoulders and said, it's all a question of dates. And she does lead an extraordinarily busy life. But she'll be going on from here to Edinburgh, to the Edinburgh Festival, with indeed this orchestra. She returns the stage now, applauded by the orchestra and the full house here, shaking hands, indeed hugging tonight's leader. She goes to Edinburgh with the orchestra, and then she has a residency, I think, at the Lucerne Festival, the summer festival. And she's always in enormous demand, both as a soloist with orchestras and indeed as a soloist on her own. You perhaps can sense the extraordinary warmth that she seems to evoke in audiences, particularly here in the Albert Hall. The promenade is wreathed in smiles, a kind of sort of benevolent look encompassing them all collectively. Well, in the second part of tonight's prom here, live on Radio 3, the home of the proms, there's just a single work. It's Hector Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. But first, we have an interval, and this evening's 20 minutes. Earlier this evening, across the road from the Royal Albert Hall at the Royal College of Music, Matthew Sweet and his guests discussed the poetry of Sylvia Plath for a Proms Plus audience.
Sylvia Plath wrote poetry and fiction in a voice so distinctive that it now seems to constitute a mode of its own. We don't talk as much about the Plathian as we do about the Dickensian or the Byronic, but when you read her work, her collections The Colossus and Ariel, for instance, or her only novel, The Bell Jar, you're hearing something that you hear nowhere else. She's also part of that small band of artists whose name has travelled beyond the literary, like Stendhal and Liszt. She's given her name to a medical term, the Sylvia Plath effect. Mm-hmm. Plath liked sunbathing, she liked basketball, she liked sweet sherry, she liked Ouija boards. Mm-hmm. She was also a Beethoven fan. And as we'll hear tonight, the music of Beethoven is legible in her writing, in the Bell Jar perhaps, particularly. Tonight, we're going to breathe the atmosphere of her work with two who know it well, the poet Lavinia Greenlaw and the literary historian Sally Bailey. Let's start with The Bell Jar. It's a rite of passage for many readers, isn't it, Lavinia? How did you discover it?
I discovered it like any other sort of overheated teenage girl and read it avidly and didn't understand its influence on me for a very long time.
Do people read it at the wrong moment then, do you think, or is that really the right moment to read it?
I think it's the right moment to read it because if you are that kind of person looking for something to meet your own intensity, it's exactly the right thing to read. But I think Plath altogether is a pretty dangerous and terrible influence.
In what way?
Well, she inspires us to write, and then we think we can write like her without having her extraordinary technical expertise and her control and her precision. I mean, you can't write madly about madness. You have to write very precisely about it in order for it to convey itself clearly. And that's exactly what she does. And The Bell Jar, while it's somebody breaking down, is full of very, very detailed, fissured images of just tracking very precisely a sensation and the movement of sensation or the loss of sense.
Sally Bailey, how did you encounter this book? Were you a teenager when you read it as well?
I was 17. I was at my sixth form college, and I remember a very flamboyant Italian girl rushing into our classroom and saying, "The Bell Jar, The Bell Jar, I've just finished The Bell Jar." And she was one of those girls who everyone paid attention to. So I quietly snuck off to the Brighton Public Library to find out about this Sylvia Plath and The Bell Jar. I was quite a serious 17-year-old, so I'm not sure if I was in the right vein to read The Bell Jar. I think The Bell Jar's extraordinarily witty, funny, exuberant, naughty, at times sadistic, It shifts all over the place. It's like being on a fairground ride.
OK, well, let's begin the ride, shall we? The actor Buffy Davis, I'm very pleased to say, is with us, and she's going to read the opening of The Bell Jar. Buffy.
It was a queer, sultry summer. The summer they electrocuted the Rosenbergs, and I didn't know what I was doing in New York. I'm stupid about executions. The idea of being electrocuted makes me sick, and that's all there was to read about in the papers. Goggle-eyed headlines staring up at me on every street corner, and at the fusty, peanut-smelling mouth of every subway. It had nothing to do with me, but I couldn't help wondering what it would be like being burned alive all along your nerves. I thought it must be the worst thing in the world.
Thanks very much, Buffy. Lavinia, 50 years since that was first published. Do you think it retains its immediacy, its freshness?
I think it does. I mean, you will find an awful lot of novels with similar shock openings. And nowadays, if I opened a novel and it began like that, I'd shut it fast because it sounds so lurid. But it's so clever the way that it's immediately she's thinking about boys and clothes and all the ordinary things and these leaking of disturbance into it. It's a very compelling balance.
There seems to be something strangely unchanged about elements of this world that she's documenting too, Sally, particularly the pressures upon her central character are not ones that feel too archival, are they?
No, not at all. I think if you had to recommend this to a 16, 17, 18-year-old girl, the same preoccupations with self, how do I look? Am I wearing the right lipstick? Have I got the right dress on? Is anyone going to take me seriously as a young woman? How do I walk about the place? How do I find my way in and out of places? You know, those kinds of concerns, that self-consciousness of young women.
I mean, that's why it's much easier when you're older to see the humour in it, because when you're reading it at 17, you're thinking, exactly, you know, I would spend all night worrying about the dresses in my cupboard or how to part my hair. But now we look at it and we laugh.
And what's going on in this opening moment, then? This is something about losing control, isn't it? There's something already beginning to show here, isn't it?
Her thought processes are losing control. So, like everyone else in New York, she will be walking past headlines saying the Rosenbergs are about to be executed. But the image that forms in her head is the memory of the one time she's seen a dead body. Mm. And there's this extraordinary image of how the head of that drowned man, she feels as if she's carrying it around on the string, like a balloon, a brown balloon that stinks of vinegar. Mm. So you've got in that the actual memory, a very shocking physical memory of this body, and what her imagination is doing with it, and the feeling that she's carrying it around on a string so she cannot escape the horrors. Mm. So everything is detonating for her.
So where's it leading us, Sally?
I think everything's a specimen in Plath's world, you know? The culture that surrounds her is a specimen. The Rosenbergs are a specimen. Eisenhower is a specimen. She desiccates and she undoes everything. She pulls everything apart in a very forensic way. But I think this is a woman writer with a great deal of aplomb, trying to imitate both a teenager and an older woman. And I think to go back to the teenage Plath, if you like. Teenagers are very cruel. They do dissect people. Everyone is a specimen under their gaze. And I think she does that brilliantly. I love the way she uses the word stupid. She's not afraid to use the word stupid. I'm stupid about executions.
Sally, you've already mentioned the humour in the book. And it struck me, you know, having read it as well as a teenager and going back to it just in the last few days, what a very funny book it is. I want to show that with a moment from the novel when the heroine, Esther Greenwood, and a girlfriend, Betsy, begin to feel the poisonous effects of eating a dodgy crab meat and avocado salad. Buffy.
Betsy looked a fright. The bloom was gone from her cheeks, and her drained face floated in front of me, green and sweating. We fell into one of those yellow checkered cabs that are always waiting at the curb when you are trying to decide whether or not you want a taxi. And by the time we reached the hotel, I had puked once, and Betsy had puked twice. The cab driver took the corners with such momentum that we were thrown together, first on one side of the back seat and then on the other. Each time one of us felt sick, she would lean over quietly as if she had dropped something and was picking it up off the floor. And the other one would hum a little and pretend to be looking out the window. The cab driver seemed to know what we were doing, even so. "Hey!" he protested, driving through a light that had just turned red. "You can't do that in my cab! You better get out and do it in the street."
Thanks, Buffy.
Sally, why do people never say that witty writer, Sylvia Plath, that master of comic observation, Sylvia Plath?
I think there's a compulsion to narrate her life through death, and it's a traumatic loop that we seem to go through every time we mention the name Sylvia Plath, and we can't get off that traumatic loop or that record skipping. I find it particularly frustrating. I'm much more interested in the extraordinary richness of register that she holds, just in the passage that you just read, Buffy, the way we slide between voices so brilliantly. She's a ventriloquist. She's a puppet master.
And she's not actually setting out to be funny. She's setting out to be truthful.
Is there a sort of, I mean, if we can pursue a sort of musical allegory, is there some kind of counterpoint going on here between the comic and the gruesome?
Yes, I think there is. And I think it comes very quickly upon you. You mentioned Beethoven in your introduction. And about the same time that she was writing The Bell Jar, she and Ted Hughes were listening on their gramophone record to Beethoven, particularly the Grosse Fuge, which is that extraordinary counterpoint composition which lurches very dramatically and emotionally from being very quiet to being very loud and kind of cartoonish, if you like. When Buffy was performing just now, I was seeing an American cartoon, actually, with voices.
Cartoonishness is not something that we associate with her poetry, though, is it, Lavinia? Are her prose and her poetry performed in different voices?
No, but I think that this feeling of cartoonishness comes from the fact that poets, like all artists, find it harder than they think to set aside their own dignity. Mm. And Plath will do that, and she will go up high or down low to reach the exact image. That's the mark of a great artist who doesn't sort of get stopped by saying, actually, this isn't very elegant. And she'll go right into the pathetic, but do so in a way that actually makes it far more serious, not without diffusing anything.
Was she writing poetry and prose simultaneously?
Yes, she was, yes. So she's drafting The Bell Jar at exactly the same time that she's practicing her great voice masterpiece, Elm. So, and her poem, Elm, which is an extraordinary odyssey through the process of practicing and rehearsing, like music, like composition, line after line after line. I think we're going to hear that in a moment.
We are.
And on the other side of these manuscript drafts is The Bell Jar. And it feels like an extraordinary juxtaposition. But one of the things I think that holds them together is the experimental quality of her voice.
Buffy, can we hear Elm, please?
"I know the bottom," she says. "I know it with my great tap root. It is what you fear. I do not fear it. I have been there. Is it the sea you hear in me, its dissatisfactions, or the voice of nothing that was your madness? Love is a shadow, how you lie and cry after it. Listen. These are its hoofs. It has gone off like a horse. All night I shall gallop thus, impetuously, till your head is a stone, your pillow a little turf, echoing, echoing. Or shall I bring you the sound of poisons? This is rain now, this big hush. And this is the fruit of it, tin white, like arsenic. I have suffered the atrocity of sunsets. Scorched to the root, my red filaments burn and stand, a hand of wires. Now I break up in pieces that fly about like clubs. A wind of such violence will tolerate no bystanding. I must shriek. The moon also is merciless. She would drag me cruelly, being barren. Her radiance scathes me. Or perhaps I have caught her. I let her go. I let her go, diminished and flat, as after radical surgery. How your bad dreams possess and endow me. I am inhabited by a cry. Nightly it flaps out, looking with its hooks for something to love. I am terrified by this dark thing that sleeps in me. All day I feel its soft, feathery turnings, its malignity. Clouds pass and disperse. Are those the faces of love, those pale irretrievables? Is it for such I agitate my heart? I am incapable of more knowledge. What is this? This face so murderous in its strangle of branches, its snaky acid's kiss. It petrifies the will. These are the isolate, slow faults that kill. That kill. That kill.
Thank you very much, Buffy. Lavinia, there is something sort of inescapable about this poem, isn't it? We are addressed so directly in such a seemingly confessional way.
Yes, and it's, for me, an oddly incoherent poem. It's one in which, as Sally says, Plath is trying out different voices, and you have lines and phrases which are very clinical, like, you know, clinical, the isolate, slow faults, the pale irretrievables, very cool, clinical language. And then a line which, for me, comes from a bad pop song. I have suffered the atrocity of sunsets.
So are we wrong, then, to think of all of this poetry as absolutely coherent, like totally attached to this very sort of formed personality? Should we think of these as more broken objects,
absolutely,
as if we were reading T.S. Eliot, perhaps?
No, absolutely. The fragment, absolutely. The idea of the fragment is running all the way through this poem. I mean, she encourages us to think of the drama of the fragment. It's almost as if we are inside the voice itself. The voice is a kind of sound chamber, and the tree is the sound chamber, and she's chucking out sound bites. She's practicing sound bites. She's practicing hearing herself shriek out loud.
Lavinia, you've also chosen a poem for us, one from Ariel, Sheep in Fog. Why did you pick this one?
It's my favourite Plath poem. I think it's an extraordinary... It's short, it's clear, and an extraordinary evocation of this ambivalence she has about dissolution, disappearance. This poem is so poised as to give us an utter sense of the joy and release and desire for that release, as well as the sort of horror of being in a truly empty space.
Shall we hear it, Buffy? Sheep in Fog.
The hills step off into whiteness. People or stars regard me sadly. I disappoint them. The train leaves a line of breath. Oh, slow horse, the color of rust. Hooves, darless bells. All morning, the morning has been blackening, a flower left out. My bones hold a stillness. The far fields melt my heart. They threaten to let me through to a heaven starless and fatherless, a dark water.
Thank you, Buffy. Lavinia, there's a sort of elusive quality to the language in this poem, isn't there, which befits something that's defined around this image of the sheep somewhere out there in the atmosphere of this world. But where are we going at the end here? Because we seem to be offered a sort of clarity, don't we?
Well, it's either clarity or complete absence of anything. I mean, when Sylvia Plath read this poem on the radio, she said, "This poem is called Sheep in Fog. It's about some sheep in fog." And I think she was deliberately grounding us so that we didn't sort of disappear off into it. But I think her instinct was to remind us that this is about a very ordinary but at times extreme response we have when suddenly we can't make sense. We can't make sense of what we're looking at. We can't make sense of ourselves. We can't find the language. We've lost the language. We've lost tension and coordinates. And people are drawn very much to that last image, starless and fatherless, a dark water. But you have to look at what comes just before that, where she says, "They threaten to let me through to a heaven." So you've got threaten and heaven, almost rhyming, but really opposing each other. Is this a place she wants to go, or is it a place that she is being taken?
I began by asking you both about your first encounters with the bell jar. What does Plath's poetry do for us now? We sort of understand it in its historical context, perhaps. How does it speak to us now, Sally?
Well, I think hearing it again today here, I'm reminded again of that line in Elm about the bystander. And it's this idea of a voice that stands completely alone. It's utterly, utterly inimitable.
And what would life be like without her, Lavinia? I mean, how has she shaped your sensibility?
Well, I think we have many gifted and expert writers, but this combination of gift and expertise with a kind of radical drive to really push as hard as you can to get at the exact edge of language is so rare, and she still feels far more shocking, disturbing, and ambitious than many people writing now.
And that's all we have time for, I'm afraid. I'm off now to treat our guests to some crab and avocado salad. But before that happens, will you join me in thanking Sally Bailey, Lavinia Greenlaw, and Buffy Davis?
Matthew Sweet and his guests were discussing the work of the poet and novelist Sylvia Plath, who died 50 years ago this year. The producer was Gareth Croyle. And the Proms Plus Festival takes place at the Royal College of Music just about every night of the Proms season, as well as being here on Radio 3 in 20 minutes. Full details online on the website. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and to Radio 3, the home of the Proms, with me, Christopher Cook. There's just one work in the second half of tonight's concert. Marius Janssens conducts the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra in a performance of Hector Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. Composed in 1830, the symphony was born out of unrequited love, and it was William Shakespeare who played Cupid to the composer when Berlioz first saw the actress Harriet Smithson as Ophelia in a production of Hamlet in Paris in 1827. Shakespeare, coming upon me unawares, Berlioz was to write in his memoirs, struck me like a thunderbolt, and so did Miss Smithson. But alas, the actress wasn't as mad for the musician as he was for her. Berlioz's ecstasy turned to agony and his thoughts to the Symphonie Fantastique, with its subtitle Episodes from the Life of an Artist. A wonderfully unconventional life told in a symphony that very much goes its own way, so it's in five, not four, movements. Then there's the musical idée fixe, a theme associated with the woman who has spurned the composer and from which so much of the music in the symphony is developed. Finally, it's a work with a literary programme that begins with a young musician trying to overdose on opium, but swallowing only just enough to plunge him into a deep sleep, accompanied by the strangest of dreams and nightmares, in which he murders the beloved, he is danced with at a glittering ball, and is marched to the scaffold and ends up at a witch's Sabbath. Tonight's conductor is Marius Janssens.
Berlioz, you know, put very interesting new things, very much in orchestration, instrumentation. And what, of course, this symphony gives you a lot of possibilities to fantasy, because this is a program music, the story and so the musical atmosphere. Somehow on the stage we must try to make understanding and to feeling the public what we want to say with this music. Or I would say not we, but what Berlioz wanted to say through our interpretation. But I think this music, the orchestra should play with the passion and with emotions, not so academical way, because this can become, you know, very routine, and I would even say boring. Even that the music is so exciting, but still, you know, I think you must be very, very lively during the performance. Then I think it becomes, I think, interesting.
Marius Janssens. And it's a very large orchestra that we have on the stage at the moment. And as he was telling me also when we met this morning, it is a piece, Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, that really gives an opportunity for the orchestra to show itself and the kind of colours it can make. It really is a kind of orchestral piece, I think, indeed. And also that Janssens has taken the opportunity to use the hall itself, as you're going to hear. But here he is, the chief conductor of the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, for a performance of Hector Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique.
Thank you. Thank you.
Belarus's Symphonie Fantastique, Boris Janssen, is conducted the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, led tonight by Anton Tarkovsky. And the Die Zero that we heard in the last movement of the symphony ushered in a rather different day of judgment for Hector Berlioz than for his hero. In time, the composer married his muse and Harriet Smithson became Madame Berlioz, but the relationship ended badly. Tonight, though, has ended splendidly with this performance of Berlioz's symphony, the Symphonie Fantastique. And what a compendium of European romanticism it is, what with opium-eating, witches, unrequited love, but above all, of course, the artist, in this case the composer, as an outsider. Perhaps seeing more about society, but nonetheless outside society, unwanted and spurned. Now, Janssen, returning to the platform, greeted warmly, with applause, tapping of bows on desks by members of his orchestra. Bringing his feet for anglais player from the orchestra. Other members of the woodwind, too. The timpanist, and you perhaps heard during the third movement at the end, where the storm breaks in upon the country scene, up at the top of the Albert Hall, the two sets of timpani rumbling away as the storm. Members of the percussion team. The brass now, two harpists, and of course the strings on their feet. The Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra was founded in 1949. Marius Janssens has been its chief conductor since 2003, 10 years, and it's had an immensely distinguished roster of chief conductors, founded by Eugen Jochum, but including after him Raphael Kubelik, Sir Colin Davis and Lauren Marzell, all of whom developed an extraordinary wide-ranging with this orchestra, repertoire with this orchestra, but Marius Janssens has continued. They play not only the classics, but of course they also play a great deal of contemporary music, and always have done, including in the past Stravinsky, Mio, Hindemith, Boulez, but more recently Stockhausen, Cargill, Luciano Berio and Peter F. Fox. The audience, as always in the traditional proms way, greeting Marius Janssens as he returns to the platform. And if you'd like to hear tonight's prom again, then it'll be available for 7 days after this broadcast via the Radio 3 website and the BBC iPlayer. And I should add that my colleague Katie Derham will be discussing this evening's concert on this week's edition of Proms Extra on BBC Two this coming Saturday at 7:30. Well, I suspect what the orchestra are hoping for, and maybe the promenaders are expecting, is indeed an encore of some kind. That tradition for the companies visiting orchestras when they come to the proms. Certainly the stamping, clapping, cheering was all, I think, to egg tonight's conductor, Marius Janssens, on to and on call. And I think they have succeeded. She's brought the orchestra to their feet, though. Turn psychologist. The Full House, a quite astonishing sight here at the Albert Hall. So many people. I don't think I've ever been here when it's been quite so full. Yes, we are indeed to have an encore. as I've said, the Bavarian Orchestra have a bit contemporary music. But how many of you would have guessed that that strange Hungarian dance that sounded a little kind of after Brahms or indeed Dvořák was in fact by Georges Ligeti? It was his Concert Romanesque, played with enormous verve, as an encore should be. I ought to explain the laughter before the encore. Two ladies of a certain age were making their way out of the hall, perhaps not expecting an encore, and they caught Marie-Chantal's eye on the podium. And he very gallantly stopped, allowing them to find seats. They didn't want to find seats, but eventually they were helped to seats, and we had the encore. A wonderfully English moment, I think, that here at the Proms. Marie-Chantal again brings tonight's leader to his feet, and indeed the whole orchestra too. Well, the next prom here on Radio 3, Home of the Proms, is in just under an hour, I suppose. Nigel Kennedy is the soloist in Vivaldi's The Four Seasons with the Palatine Strings, an ensemble of young musicians, mainly from the West Bank and East Jerusalem, are making their very first appearance here at the BBC Proms, and also with members of Kennedy's own band, the Orchestra of Life. And I'll be back with Marius Janssens and the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra tomorrow evening for a performance of just one work that might have been written specifically for this great Royal Albert Hall and indeed a Proms performance. It's Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection. But as the applause, I think, is determined to continue here for a good deal while now, I'm going to hand you back to Jonathan Swain in Broadcasting House from the Royal Albert Hall for an hour or so.
Christopher, thank you very much. Christopher Cook there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there'll be another chance to hear tonight's prom here on BBC Radio 3 on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Also, if you want to listen to it when you want to listen to it, every prom's available to listen to online via the Radio 3 website anytime you like for 7 days from the broadcast. Well, keeping the proms in the frame, an invitation now from Ian McMillan.
I'm here to tell you there's still time to enter this year's Proms Poetry Competition. All you have to do is write a poem inspired by any piece of music in this year's Proms season. There are two categories, one for children and one for adults. And the winners will have their poems read out at a Proms Plus event and then broadcast on Radio 3. Oh, and they'll also get to meet me, which is a prize in itself. For details of how to enter, including full terms and conditions, visit bbc.co.uk/proms or simply type Proms Poetry Competition into your search engine. The closing date is the 9th of August, so get writing. And I personally would love to get poems from people who've never written a poem before. Go on, have a go. Now, what rhymes with Benjamin Britten?
Ian McMillan. So, as Christopher Cook said, tonight is a double prom night. Nigel Kennedy's Vivaldi prom is at 10:15 after our feature on cultural life in Kashmir. Tomorrow night is a double prom night too. The Bavarians and Marius Janssens in Mahler's Resurrection Symphony. That starts here on Radio 3 at 7 o'clock. And then at 10 o'clock, we're back at the Royal Albert Hall for the Easter theme from J.S. Bach. Sir John Eliot Gardiner conducting the Monteverdi Choir and English Baroque soloists in Bach's Easter and Ascension oratorios. And Bach right now via Busoni. Busoni, born in the 1860s, and for Busoni, the composer and virtuoso pianist, Bach was the alpha of keyboard composers. This is one of Busoni's transcriptions for piano of Bach organ chorale preludes. The pianist is Murray Pariah. Bach organ chorale prelude transcribed for the piano by the Italian composer-pianist Ferruccio Busoni. Busoni was a contemporary of Rachmaninoff and famous for his aphorisms, and one of them, the old and the new are the same, may account for his many recreations of pieces by Bach. That one was of the chorale prelude Nun komm der Heidenheiland, BWV 659, and the pianist was Murray Pariah. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 9:30, and time now for this evening's feature. Over its 5,000-year history, Kashmir has been ruled by Afghans, Mughals, Buddhists, Hindu princes, and of course the British, before being divided between India and Pakistan in the aftermath of independence. In his second report from India, broadcast originally last October, Jatinder Verma explores the cultural fallout of the 1989 revolt in Indian Kashmir by its Muslim majority. He looks at India's changing relationship with Kashmir as expressed in its cinema, and he examines the particular place that Kashmir holds in the Indian imagination.
It's Independence Day here in the heart of Delhi. The streets and parks are full of people. It's a public holiday, of course, and the mood is joyous. You might imagine that the same scene is being repeated throughout India. For filmmaker Sanjay Kak, the reality of Independence Day in Kashmir's capital, Srinagar, provided the haunting opening idea for his film on Kashmir, Jashn-e-Azadi.
I was in Srinagar on 15th of August. And I remember walking down to Lal Chowk, which is the sort of commercial heart of Srinagar, Red Square, literally. And there was the flag hoisting going on. And there must have been perhaps maybe 100 soldiers and nobody else. And I then started walking away from the city square towards what's called downtown Srinagar. You could have thought that there's like a plague in town or something, because there was nobody on the street. This needs to be interrogated. You know, how is it that Indian Independence Day, it's met with such strong opposition? You know, what is this? This is not an ordinary protest.
Watch out!
India's independence was achieved in 1947 by the creation of an arbitrary border along religious lines by the British Raj. This partitioning displaced over 12 million people, with more than 1 million killed in the terrible confusion of crossing the new borders between India and Pakistan. In 1989, with the collapse of the old global world order, following the fall of the Soviet Empire, Kashmir became yet another territory militantly seeking self-determination, prompting the Indian state to turn it into the most militarized place on earth. Today, there is a sense that Kashmir is normalized as Indian tourists return in large numbers to their Himalayan playground. Has military might really won a peace for Kashmir? Gautam Kaul, a Kashmiri who became head of the Indo-Tibet Border Police Force and who found himself fighting the militancy.
My force, my boys and my officers, they all contributed to attempts to bring peaceful conditions back to the valley and its people. We were first trying to wean away the young people back to the normal mainstream life, telling them not to listen to all the crap and propaganda that was on in their bylanes, in their mosques. We were explaining to them the virtues of prosperity and the fact that the kind of propaganda which was coming from across the border, how hollow it was, how selfish it was. And that was one aspect, and we were fairly successful there. Now, those who didn't listen, our policy was, or at least my policy was, if you have taken the gun against the state, then you are actually against everything that the state professes. And we have declared ourselves to be democratic, a socialistic democratic republic. Now, that's a very fine philosophy.
While the military presence in Kashmir has been reduced, over 500,000 security forces remain and their presence is overwhelming. The idea of peace for many, including writer and human rights activist Gautam Navlaka and Kashmiri journalist Fahad Shah, is neither hopeful nor convincing.
The so-called peace that appears on the surface is a result of a police control, where it's a military rule, it's a situation where they can go in and destroy houses and things like that, summoning somebody for interrogation again and again. And you see a number of people, so after 2010, kids who were picked up, and primarily youth below the age of 18, their numbers were very large. Kids have to appear at the police station every second day or every week. What I'm trying to say is this kind of a climate that actually at the ground level operates, where people have no freedom of expression, assembly, and association, three very fundamental rights without which to talk about democracy is meaningless. And Kashmiris don't have it.
It has been an era of 24 years of conflict now, torture. More than 70,000 people have been killed and 10,000 are disappeared. 30,000 are orphans. So how can stories be hopeful? There is no hope because India is crushing every movement. India is crushing everything. There is this continuous ban on freedom of speech. People are getting arrested even for writing something on Facebook. We don't know who will get arrested where. So there is no hope.
The Indian state, however, claims it is reacting reasonably to maintain its territorial integrity against a fundamentalist and brutal revolt in Kashmir fueled by outsiders. The government says it is fighting a terrorist-style militancy similar to that experienced by other nations, with drastic measures needed. But it strenuously denies any accusations of using undue force in achieving the current state of uneasy peace. Many Kashmiris point to the long-standing Armed Forces Special Powers Act as a symbol of their relationship with India. With stories abounding of unsolved murders, disappearances, and the recent discovery of unmarked graves, there is an acute anxiety about this particular act, according to the Srinagar-born journalist Rahul Pandita.
See, the Armed Forces Special Powers Act is a draconian law under which any officer or anyone from the armed forces, they can go in a house without any warrant and they can search and they have impunity. The Armed Forces Special Power Act in itself is not a big problem, because even when you're talking about AFSPA, there's no provision for cold-blooded murder. And there have been certain murders which have happened, cold-blooded murders. The problem really is the problem of political impunity.
This song right here, it's dedicated to my people in Kashmir. Yeah, they say when you run from darkness, all you seek is light. But when the blood spills over, you will see.
I protest. The hit by young Srinagar rap musician MC Cash echoes a much older Kashmiri tradition which is 5,000 years old. Kashmiri culture has been characterized by its mischievous wit and its disdain for authorities, whether religious or secular. Its unique form of theatre, Band Pathar, has managed to survive years of war even when many of its own participants were targeted by Islamic militants, as theatre and film director M.K. Raina explains.
These are the families where the tradition goes father to son, and it is all oral tradition. There is no written text as such, but they have a certain kind of a structure. Within that structure, they have their stories. And it is a very, very popular, humorous satire tradition in which there are maskaras. Maskaras means jesters, and who dominate. That style of acting is very much prevalent in the entire form. While there is dance, there is music, there is royalty in certain plays. And most of the plays, I would say, are quite political in the sense. They are against aristocracy, they are against royalty, they are against foreign rule, they are against British rule, and the suffering of the Kashmiri.
Band Pathar is closely linked with a tradition that perhaps until recently has defined Kashmir, Sufism, a mystic variant within Islam with links to Buddhism and Hinduism. Its cosmopolitanness is now severely undermined by terrorism, war, and competing recently imported notions of Islam. Well-known Srinagar journalist Pervez Bukhari.
Sufism has actually meant a certain sophisticated kind of syncretism. You know, Sufism in Kashmir was not exclusive either to Islam or to Hindu faith. It has been, and it still survives to a significant measure, it no doubt does, a pan-faith, culturally cohesive phenomenon of understanding and accommodation and an independent practice of different faiths. all said and done, till about 1990, this place, Kashmir, has had a very glorious history of coexistence and communal amity.
Kashmir was at the cross-current subcultures. I call it a lab where the ideas churned. I mean, if you say Sufi music of India, it is Islamic. In Kashmiri Sufism is diverse. Its images are Buddhist, its images are Hindu, its images are Islamic. Currents coming from Central Asia, Persia, India, and something else was being brewed and cooked there, which is very unique, very different.
It's this difference that has all